My name is Caesar. People call me Riley Eller. I'm a director of special projects. We do government contract fulfillment for the United States. At COCO Communications, the company does mesh networking. It's secure, wireless, or wired names, networks, unlike the anonymous internet protocols. I'm a little more well-known for working with the ghetto hackers in the Capture the Flag contest at DEF CON. We won the contest 3 years running and decided after that to take over in order to provide a more reliable and believable game that entertained the audience more. My job on that team was to invent a scoring system, something that people would understand and be able to access when they look at the scores, understand what that meant. That has led to the speech I'm giving today. And what I intend to address are the problems of security training, which have less to do with the training itself and more to do with understanding the results, understanding how well a security professional has absorbed the information, how effectively they can provide services as consultants, and whether or not they are qualified administrators, security qualifications. The four major problems that we're going to come up against when trying to measure the training that's been absorbed by people are as follows. Computer security problems are never going away. They will not disappear. Even if we consistently inspect and defend the systems that we care about, testing is always, always ahead of development. And what I mean by that is people will test and find vulnerabilities before someone can develop a patch or a way to stop that problem. Hackers know more than administrators. By this, what I mean to say is hackers are necessarily testers. They're ahead of the game. They are testing whatever came out of the administration, whatever came out of the development in the last round. Any given hacker has to focus only on one problem. Any problem they find, any chink in the armor, any small way to invade a system. As an administrator, I have to defend every invader. I have to defend every possible way through the armor or through the defenses. There's no way to catch up. Next, consultants are hard to measure. By this, I mean if you hire PricewaterhouseCooper and Deloitte & Touche to perform a service, you rely on their reputation, and that's all you have. You don't know when the job is finished, whether it was done well, whether the people they sent to do the job are good. You really have no way to measure the value that was brought back by your expenditure of money. And finally, the last security training problem is that administrators need to minimize the amount of time after the discovery of a vulnerability, the presentation of an exploit, and the patch to where that's no longer a problem. My solution is to use games of any variety to test competitively different teams of or individual security professionals. The game that I'm most familiar with is the Capture the Flag format. The Capture the Flag game has the properties that I find very valuable in that it spreads security techniques, measures the skill of the people who are playing, and strengthens the team management. I want to talk for a moment about security contests as encouraging criminal behavior. Quite the opposite they bring out the best in the players who show up, and perhaps that would be a criminal or someone bad, but when they show their skills in a public forum, then all of the good guys in the room get to learn from that. The professionals who are in the room will absorb those skills, understand them, and go home able to defend against people at the level of the bad guy. And elevating the skill of defenders is fundamentally the only way to improve the defense of companies. Given that, we'll never catch up to the attackers. The attacker will always have an edge. If we can make that edge very small, then we can use countermeasures, defenses, and other mechanisms to punish the attackers, especially if we can catch them just after the vulnerability's been patched. Security is so complex that it's almost impossible to measure even the complexity. Making a game where the winner and loser are understood and believable answers, that when we say this team wins or that team wins, that everyone in the room will believe it and understand it, it's a very challenging job. In spreading the security techniques by using capture the flag games, what we do is accelerate the learning curve for administrators. So in other words, we put them in fire and we test them and they come out stronger. The only other option, other than training administrators the techniques of hackers, is to become a victim and to agree that we'll be victimized and to accept that hit to our stock prices and the values of our companies and our reputations. So this isn't optional. This isn't an interesting idea. It's critically important that we begin to measure the capabilities of the people that we pay. If we can convince hackers to come into public and show their skills, we can learn exactly what the state of the art is. Because as we said in the panel, or as I said in the panel, some exploits wait a decade to be discovered. And that means that millions and millions of computers can be attacked and no one knows. So it's not a difference of 6 weeks between zero day and patch. Sometimes it's 6,000 weeks, or at least 600 weeks. So getting the hackers in public, letting them show off their skills, requires that we make prizes or some enticement, trophies, money, something to bring them out. But if we do that, the value is that we can understand how good the best is, and from there, then we can begin to measure how good better and how good and fair and poor. And no two people will ever perform identically in a given test. And so it's important that the testing method that we use is resilient in that it measures many small events instead of one large event. So that if there's error in the measurement or random responses due to just the format of the game, we have enough that we can detect the pattern of skill. We can detect the pattern of excellence or of lack of excellence. With a well-considered scoring system, with well-thought-through math, we can actually measure how much better he is than I am, or he is than she is, and so forth. So rather than running away from the complexity problem and giving up and becoming victims, the Ghetto Hackers Capture the Flag game and my scoring system were developed specifically to do the best thing possible. And it requires participation, but that's about it. To learn from performance, we need to carefully measure the events that have happened. So each exploit, each information theft, each SQL injection, the effects, not necessarily the techniques though, The nice thing is that the game can be consistent. The scoring can stay the same even when the exploit techniques change, as long as we think through the system well enough. We really want to measure the effectiveness of a team, and this is their attacking or defensive strength, their responsiveness, so this is how rapidly they change strategies when they see the performance and behaviors of the other teams, and how well they coordinate their efforts. Team coordination is difficult to measure, but not impossible. We want to learn more, we will learn more from competition than from testing. In the States, we have a test called the SAT, and people don't study the subjects any longer, they study the test, and that's a real problem anywhere you have standardized testing. So instead of just making a certification process that people can memorize the answers, spit out the answers, and then receive their diploma, we put the teams in opposition. Format of Capture the Flag came from a children's game used to simulate small team combat. I don't know how many... is anyone in the audience familiar with the children's game Capture the Flag by show of hands? Has anyone seen this before? A few people have. The simple explanation of this game is that in a field or a neighborhood or anywhere that has reduced visibility, we take two handkerchiefs or ties or visibly apparent, anything like that, divide the children in two groups, send them away. They hide this somewhere that's usually visible from 20 feet or some small distance. They hide it, they defend it, and it is a game of tag, so when the child touches another child, then the touched person is out of the game. And each team then tries to go and acquire the other team's flag. In a digital sense, we try to do the same mechanism because it's such a simple format that people natively understand. Defend mine and attack yours. The symmetry makes all the measurements necessarily fair. The additional thing is symmetrical combat games encourage deception and subtlety, which are the exact techniques that we expect to see in the hackers who are making our lives hell. A little bit of background about the evolution of the game at DEF CON. In the first 3 years of the DEF CON Capture the Flag contest, there were free terminals provided to sit down and use to talk with each other. Network to computer access was rarer in those days. The standard behavior that came out is exactly what we would expect from teenage and early 20s males, especially technically skilled ones. They immediately began attacking each other's use of the terminals. It was supposed to be a cooperative, fun event, but instead they turned it into a contest and started taking access away from each other. At DEF CON 4, the game was formalized and announced in the invitation to the contest, and the contest holders brought server machines in and set them up and sold access to the network for, I think, $2, and hook your network cable in and try to hack the machines that were provided. Every time you rooted a box, you get 1 point. And every time, at the end of the contest, who was the last person to root the box got an extra point. And this was to encourage people to stay and play for longer times. And judges were used at that time to measure whether a root was good enough or whether the intrusion had been successful. There's no evidence to support any claim that the contest was fair, that the participants had equal time or equal access, or that whatever happened then is meaningful today. DEF CON 5 and 6 invited participants either to provide more servers to be attacked or instead to attack servers. So this sets up the first notion of there being defensive players or people trying to win as administrators. This is the origination of the claim or the administrative side. This makes it legitimate. As before, it was really very much a hacker skill contest and had no application for commercial users. They made promises during these years to improve the technology of the scoring, but they didn't. It was exactly the same each year. Judges would announce that a victory had been made, and at the end of the contest, 4 points might be the winner, or 70 points. But the game didn't really change. DEF CON 7, 8, and 9 were the years that my team came in and dominated the contest. To give you an idea, just real fast before we move forward, in the worst year, our team scored more points than all of the other teams scored in all of the other years combined. In our best year, we scored more points than was reasonably possible because we cheated. We cheated every year, and we beat the game by beating the game because we wanted to win. And that is the exact behavior we should expect of a contest, is that people will do everything to win. So we should make a game that is perfectly suited for cheaters, a game where the whole idea is to cheat. And in fact, that's exactly what we should call hackers. All they do is cheat at the rules. We give them rules, they break the rules, and they win, we lose. So we should make a game that encourages that. The best way is to take out the middle, take out the rules, and make the teams directly compete against each other. So it's less of whether it's cheating or playing fair, and more of it, who cheats better, which is exactly what the security skill measures. One of the reasons why we were able to win in these methods these 3 years is that the rules changed rapidly, and we were simply more stubborn and more willing to fight through bad rules, and a lot of, frankly, more skilled teams walked away because they were so frustrated with the contest. Other teams did appear to be competitive at times, but the short is that they only tried 80% or 90% to cheat, and we tried 100%. And I want to make sure that it's really clear. We didn't win on skill as much as we won on winning. After the 9th year, when teams began to complain that we were cheating every year and the contest was no fun, we decided to take over and begin running the contest. And so for the last 3 years, we provided the contest for no money. We just did it because we loved the idea of an excellent capture the flag security contest. This is the first year, 10, 11, and 12, all 3 years, we presented the 18 format. This is a star central router with 8 computers, 8 network cables extending out on the compass rows. There were a few technical difficulties with the scoreboard in DEF CON 11, but now that the system has been developed for 3 years, it's really fairly mature, and we believe that at DEF CON 12 we invested about 2 man months of effort. And I say man because the team was composed of, the coders were all male. There were no women. There are a couple of women in the Ghetto Hackers, but they don't contribute to this contest. Actually, Evil Girl did this year, but aside. The talking head experiment was genesis of the problems at DEF CON 11. And this was to present a robot newscaster whose idea was to watch the scoreboard change, write new stories to simulate news, and then speak them with a automated talking head and text-to-speech synthesizer. Let's see. This year we reverted to a simpler scoreboard, and the system became very stable, and the contest was excellent. Does. As I just said a minute ago, the system topology is 8 teams scattered around a central router in a star pattern. They each get one Cat5 cable that connects into a computer that we built. It has 8 network interfaces. Each network interface is attached inside on Linux to a user mode Linux computer. And then there's a 9th user mode Linux for the scoreboard, and attempt to connect them all together. So none of the devices have any ability whatsoever to cross network information together except through small access ports. And on those access ports, we use forward and reverse NAT. So the IP address you connect to for everything is always the same, and every inbound network connection connects to you from the same IP address. The idea is to make it impossible to tell when the scoreboard is talking to your server or a different team. The value here is that we can use the scoreboard to verify when your services are functional and when, on the other hand, they've gone down or you've overprotected the service and actually made it no longer function. Of course, the ultimate defense in this game, just like in life, is to quit and not play. But that doesn't go in the corporate world. That doesn't work. We have to play. We have to succeed. And so we use a scoreboard to force the players to continually provide network service, and then they use that network service knowledge, the guarantee for the other team, as their way of knowing that they can attack. The ninth team, the ninth virtual machine, resides in the router, and it runs in a loop, running the same process over and over again. It makes up some tokens, money, if you will, and hands out one token to every service for every team, and sets a timer to go back and collect those tokens at a later point. The players abuse vulnerabilities in the servers to discover the tokens in whatever format they're currently being stored. So, for instance, one of the services is a wiki. And so we make one wiki page with a token on it. So if you can discover the name of the wiki page, then you can get the token data back. And so what people use is the word search, and they just type token into the search field, and it reveals the entire token database. And that's the vulnerability. That's the correct use of a wiki, but it demonstrates, Mr. Google was talking about, demonstrates that search engines are often used to exploit information storage. So what we would expect is that the players would open the wiki source code and remove the word token from any search. But then, as David was just talking about, there's almost always a way to sneak the request in anyway. So it's very difficult to defend a wiki being used for private storage, but teams did it, and teams did a fairly good job at it. And I think if people paid attention to what these teams were doing, they could use the techniques that they used to defend themselves against Google attacks, which aren't really attacks, but they are a very effective way of penetrating information security in an automated fashion, which is exactly what we're trying to get the teams to demonstrate and to learn. And these are the skills we want to promote. And they're very cutting edge and very up to date, even though it really didn't take our team very much time to adapt the game to train and to measure these skills. The scoring system didn't need to change at all for those reasons. The scoreboard queries emulate very normal and natural usage, and by having natural traffic to analyze, this gives the attackers all the information they need to develop and deploy new techniques for attacking the services that are provided. The tokens themselves are just long strings of numbers. The first part of it is a handle, if you will, and the last part is an encrypted hash with some extra information, including the originating team and some other piece of information. We'll get into in a second to the content of the tokens. But the important part about the tokens is that they're just data. They just need to be stored and retrieved. There's no magic. There's no programming language. There's no information at all required except that I hand you a token, you hold it, you give it back to me when I ask for it. And you only give it back to me. And this is the exact format of web cookies, of order IDs, of credit card numbers, of all the information on the internet that needs to be secured follows the same pattern. I give it to you for a while, you prove that you have it later, that you know it later, and you don't give it back to anybody else. So this format of the contest is universal, and it doesn't have any application or any connection to how it's applied. You just write services. You just write services to store and retrieve information. Information leaks are what happens when abusive players or hackers, attackers, get in and get the token that they weren't supposed to be able to see. So they pull the token, they see it on a web page, they copy and paste that into a program we provide that exchanges the token. And so let me talk about the token format itself for a moment. In the notes for this slide in your book, there's actually a real token down at the bottom. It's a big, long number starting with 7GAL. It's a big number. It doesn't matter what the content is. The three parts of the token are the expiration time, the base, which is used as the request half, and then the token itself, which is the response half. So the service will store a token with a base as a handle. So the name of a page in a wiki would be the base, and the content of the page would be the whole token. And so if we ask for the base later, then we know that the web service has, the wiki has, stored and retrieved the whole information, and that they're not cheating as defenders, that they're, if you will, holding the whole credit card number. We encode them in Base64, which gives the text format you see in the notes. We use that so that they're universally compatible. They can store in email, they can store on web pages, they can store anywhere. Periodically, the scoring system executes the deposit method. And so on a SQL database, this might be an update values or insert into, on a wiki, this might be add page, email, this might be SMTP. Send. Every deposit is timed for later withdrawal. And if another team penetrates the security and finds the string of the token, then they can exchange it. And those are the only three methods that are needed to make this whole system work. When they exchange the token, that uploads it to the router, and the router says, I know this token, I've seen it before, it's not yet expired, it's valid, and you are not the team to whom I gave the information. So the token is invalidated, and a new token is issued with the same expiration time and handed back to the attacker. Now the attacker has to defend that token as if it was their own defense. And so in this way, even the attacks, we can track how rapidly attack backs happen. And so as we'll see in the slides later, we can see that teams developed offenses to attack back and retake their tokens. And the only way that we know how to measure that they've taken the token back and forth is by issuing new tokens every time. So that's why we don't score points immediately. The other reason that no points are scored during the exchange process is because we want to make sure that the team has to defend everything. Not only their own services, but the attacks that they give later. This is a fine detail, but it reveals a lot of information about the attacked team's ability to learn from the attacks. We score the final scores are calculated in three categories, and we don't mix until the very final moment the category scoring, and it's important to understand why this happens if you're developing a scoring system of your own. We give one offensive point for the last team to hold an attacked token at the withdrawal time. If the last team is the same as the original team, in other words, if I gave a team to, or gave Team Yellow a token, and they hold it for the entire period, then rather than scoring an offensive point, we give them a defensive point. We don't want to mix attacking points and defending points because it's impossible to measure how many attacks will happen during the contest ahead of time. In one contest, 1 year, the winning score was 1.5 points. There were 1,000 defensive points, but the offensive point was vastly more important. And so we don't want to say that a defensive point is worth 0.5 point or 1/1000th of a point, because another year there were 40 offensive points and only 230 defensive points. So it's very difficult ahead of time to decide what the scale or ratio for points is. So instead, we keep the defensive points and the offensive points very separate. If the information is not available where it should, where it's expected at the end of the withdrawal period, then no points are issued to anyone and the token is declared dead. Dead tokens account for more than 80% of all of the tokens issued in most contests. On your CD, the Black Hat CD, is the entire database in Microsoft Excel format. It's a pivot table, so you can test and see different thoughts of different measurements. How did red team attack yellow team? How was yellow team's defense? All of these questions are answerable in the Excel chart. This is one of the screens on, I believe, the second sheet in the Excel chart, which is the actual picture of the information. What we see here, it might be hard to read. I would ask you to refer to the pictures in the book. What we see is that the yellow team captured over the course of the 34 hours, that's from the left is the first hour of the contest, and on the right is the last hour of the contest. Across the time, the yellow team captured 302 tokens. This is a very large number compared to some of the other teams. For instance, one of the teams scored 0 defensive tokens and 0 offensive tokens. They were laughed out of the room, but it's important that we can see now, by measuring these tokens, when each team had capabilities, how they developed them in response to what. So comparing this yellow team, who scored a lot of points using the PHP Nuke and the GHI Gate services, to the red team, the red team doesn't look as impressive. It just has a feeling like the yellow team did better. In fact, that's not true. But what we do see here is that yellow team was consistent. They had attacks in all the services across every part of the contest from the seventh hour, or the sixth hour, all the way through to the end. And this is, frankly, exactly why they won. But I'd like to go a little deeper into how their scoring went by comparison to the second place yellow team. So here are all of the attacks that came against the yellow team. We see that in the 26th hour, they learned how to defend, and they stopped all the rest of the incoming attacks. Because in the 23rd and 24th hours, we see attacks against all 5 services, we know that they were very vulnerable at that point. And the 23rd and 24th hours, these are straight hours. Teams did not get up from their tables. They sat for 34 straight hours hacking and attacking. They're very tired by the end of the contest. But yellow actually improved their performance, as we see from the 26th hour on. And so this is something we can use to measure and understand how their skill related to other teams. This is the attacks from that chart that came just from the red team. These are just the attacks of the red team against the yellow team. I'll go back and forth between these slides for a moment so you can see what proportion came from the other teams. We see a pattern here that in the period on the left here, that the red team had real good success for a short time and then lost it. The yellow team figured out what was happening. And then later, fully 6 hours later, the red team finally started attacking successfully again. And this shows that the yellow team had periods where they did better than at other times. And so we can use this again, these measurements of when they were successful as compared to, for instance, when other teams were successful, maybe during the 16th hour, which would have been 4 in the morning. Maybe they were just tired. Maybe everybody else went to sleep. These are all of the yellow attacks against the red team. I don't need to compare this because it was just for a 1 hour or 4 hour period. A total of 13 tokens out of all of the 300 yellow did were against the red team. And that is pretty indicative of the fact that the red team didn't get attacked. In fact, almost every attack from anyone against the red team came from the yellow team. So we know two things. One, that the red team destroyed the other teams, and two, that only the yellow team was even really a competition. After the eighth hour, and except for a short time in the morning of the second day, nobody had a chance of defeating the red team. This is the kind of defense that I think can really make the red team proud. The red team, by the way, is the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. Chris Eagle is speaking in the other room. He was instrumental, I would say, on that team. They did just a fantastic job, and what we know after the contest is that not only are they good at what they do, but they're better than everybody else at what they do. We can use that information, and in fact, much more fine-grained elements of the information, to make a rating system to see exactly how talented their experts are. I'd like to point out, though, that they actually found a bug in our system that all the teams had a chance to find. It's a fair game because it's symmetrical. The bug that they found is that our ninth team, the scoreboard in that user mode Linux machine, had a TTL, time to live, of 255, where all the other teams, when their packets came in, had a TTL of 254 because they had gone one step farther along in the network. All a team had to do to defeat the red team's offenses or attacks was to get their TTL escalated by a value of 1. If they'd done that, then immediately they would have gone to the defenses. Unfortunately, that's actually impossible because 1 bigger than 255 is 0. In 8-bit math, and so the packets would have been dropped. But at a minimum, the other teams should have figured out that their attacks were totally unsuccessful and figured out why, and then in the same way that the red team did, and set their defenses the same way. This would have ended the contest, but thankfully only one team was smart enough to know. What we learned from the contest is that the scoring system determines the output quality of the entire game. There's no way to measure how well a contest went except by exactly how effectively the scoring or the token database or the results measure back to the skill of the players. So knowing that a team won or outperformed another team isn't enough if it doesn't tell us how much better they are than the team. One of the ways that we do that is by using small, simple scoring events. These tokens, 300 tokens on the yellow team side. Having that large of a number helps us to reduce the noise or error in our measurements. Defensive scoring gives us a chance to motivate teams to get moving in the game and to get their servers functional early. And so as part of the output, the final score, we give the defensive scoring category a 15% ratio. So 85% of the score is from offense, and roughly 15% is from defense. There's a small bandwidth penalty as well. By inducing bandwidth penalties, we eliminate the need to make a lot of rules. What we do is we take the count of packets used by each team and compare them, and the team with the most packets gets the largest penalty, and the team with the fewest packets gets no penalty. And so by doing that, it encourages the teams to use a very small number of packets, not to port scan, not to run automated detection tools. One of the reasons that security vulnerability analysis has become so easy is because automated tools can trade a lot of bandwidth to reduce the total amount of time to learn. So we punish that in order to make players learn on their own and to discover problems without the use of tools. Before we get into the math of scoring systems, I want to make sure that we've got consistent terms. So the first term is a score, and all a score is a count. It's a number of any kind that measures a number of events. Ranking is a process of determining that one player is better or worse than another player. The simplest ranking system is just a ladder. You challenge the person above you, and if you win, then you trade places. And this happens over and over until all the ranks are sorted. The rating is an actual scale of how much better two players or one player is than another. Scaling the results is crucially important if we're going to learn the most information possible from each contest. The reason is that red team destroyed all these other teams at the contest this year. Yellow team actually did very well too. If those two teams go to another contest, we need to know more than just that they were good. We need to know that they were far superior to the competition. So that if someone beats them at the new contest, some other team comes in and wins by a lot of points, then we know that that team is much, much better than the teams who played it in the first contest, rather than just a little better or better. I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge Bernd Kreimeyer. He wrote an excellent article, Rising from the Ranks, Ratings for Multiplayer Games, which appears in the online magazine Gamma Sutra. Relevant portions of his text are taken directly and put into these slides because I learned directly from him. The URL for his article is in the notes. In order to determine a successful rating algorithm, we need the following criteria. It needs to be reproducible, which means that if on two contests one team performs just as well, then we need to get the same score out. Or if all the teams perform identically, the score needs to be the same each time. Players with a comparable score should be correctly of comparable skill. And reproducible also means that the score maintains its meaning over time. So winning with a score of 10 a year ago should mean that today I would win by a score of 10 against the same people if none of us had learned anything new. The scores have to be comprehensive, which means that the average player has to instantly and intuitively understand the scores. They have to match the player's idea of significance. So what I mean by that is that we score one token, 1 point. Players understand tokens, so they understand the scores. Nothing magic comes in. There's no judgment. There's no style points. There are no questionable measurements. The performance indicators need to be detailed enough to convey sufficient meaningful information so that observers understand the nature of the scoring system and get a feeling for the player's record. What I mean by this is that in a security contest, we need to understand both the intrusion capability and the defensive capability. And so we need to be able to convey with the scoring system that when you see a score, that it has a meaning that's important to you. So that we could, for instance, write executive summaries of the performance during a contest with exact scores in the summary, and nobody will have a problem understanding how they work. They need to be well balanced. This is important. We need to assign the same rating value to each event. So this is more about the style points. But also, it needs to reflect we need to reflect that an event had happened between a team of a high skill and a low skill, or low skill to high skill. In other words, it's very easy for a bully to pick on a small child And we shouldn't count that as a high rating of excellence. In fact, we should almost discard the knowledge entirely. So what we want to do is have the scoring system balance out the expected value. In other words, a large child will always be able to defeat a small child. So we want the expectation is that they will win. And we balance that with the performance. So if the small child studies real hard and defeats the big child, then we want to say it was unexpected and a great, great performance. And so we should reward them greatly for that. As we discussed earlier, the RootFoo scoring system measures the flow of information through the network. We're going to go a little bit into theory here about measuring players and measuring peoples. The short of it is, if we're going to use a game to measure skill and we don't take the time to design the scoring system well, then the players will not play the game. No one will value the results, and it will fail. We want to provide with this game and this system information in the scoring results that reflect capability for information theft, the ability to provide durable defense, and the ability to maintain reliability during the process. It's no good to have great defenses if applying the defenses takes the service away. So you need to have live update, dynamic capabilities that would indicate excellence in security. The final requirement of a good scoring system is to reliably estimate the value of an event, of a scored event. To achieve this, we predict that the outcome will follow the comparative ranks. So we use the rank to determine the probable outcome, and we use the real outcome to adjust the rank. And in this way, it's a circular system that feeds on itself and so maintains its own integrity by not introducing outside influences. As long as we're scoring proper events and the definitions of the players don't change, in other words, players don't change teams or we don't change the rules for one team versus another team. So long as the scoring is fair, then the rating will be fair, and it will be reasonable. So an example of what I'm talking about is that if Alice attacks Bob, and we expect Alice, and Alice has a much higher rating, then we expect Alice to win, and we won't give her very many points when she does because we haven't learned a lot of information. We already knew that she would win, so we don't need to update the ratings. So the idea is to scale the amount of the rating update according to how surprising it is. And that's the entire... This is the way that we rapidly converge scores to the correct values and then stabilize them when they arrive. So here's the entire scoring algorithm. This is the entire basis for the existing chess players algorithm invented by Arpad Elo. Their system uses some strange numbers and has some flaws, but the short of it is we initialize each player to a rating of 0, and anyone who is above average will have a positive score, and anyone who is below average will have a negative score. We'll adjust that so that it's presentable later, but in the real internal ratings that the database or the server or the central organization should keep, should maintain the ratings in this positive and negative numbers format. We sample results from the actual game. So, in other words, the Excel spreadsheet on your CD can be used as the sampling of events. We predict the expected value. In other words, we analyze, for instance, yellow team took a token from red team. We say, we expected that to happen because at the beginning, both of them have a rating of 0. So we say it was 50-50, and the value of it is therefore 50% of the possible value because we didn't know. We don't know how important this information is. And because they stole the token, then we make 1 point. So we give 1/2 point to yellow, we take 1/2 point from red, and now we have new ratings for the next event that happens. Because we use the rating of the players as the scoring mathematics, then we're learning more than just whether a team wins or loses. We're actually learning how well they won and comparatively to the other teams, how important or significant that win was and how significant the entire contest is. If we know the difference between the probability of winning, then we know how well or how much we should scale the output, the change in the rating. One function that provides an excellent model is the Fermi function, and I won't bore you with the whole details of it for long, but I'll bore you for a few minutes. The short of it is that the Fermi function is a simple curve that translates any x value into a number between 0 and 1. It has two parameters, which are S and T, which are the speed of the scoring and the stability of the scoring. They're directly interrelated, and they relate to how perfect the scoring system is. So in other words, if red has more skill than yellow, and yellow cannot ever score then against red, if that was totally impossible, then they would be considered a very stable game. And so we can adjust the stability of the, we can adjust T to a very low number. In other words, we can say there's very little noise in the results. And that will make the ratings adjust very rapidly. If you win even once, then the scoring system knows that you must be very, very good because of the rules we just said. And so it will adjust the ratings very fast. In real world, yellow team can score against red, even though red team was more skilled. And so we use a T value of 2, which I'll be happy to interact with people about the exact values to use. But a value of 2 gives us a slow, stable changes in the scoring. So in other words, each event gives you a very small incremental improvement to the accuracy of the rating system. S is the speed at which we do the changes, and this also impacts the exact same thing. A high speed and low stability will mean that the scores will jump and go up and down very fast. So we don't really want to do that, but we want the numbers to be high enough that the skills rapidly approach the correct values, or the ratings approach the values that imply the skill of the players. This is the C implementation of the Fermi function. We take the difference in the two ratings. We put it through the line that says expected here is the actual Fermi function. That function is arbitrarily selected by me and by Bernd Krammeier. Because it just has excellent properties of scaling all numbers to 0 to 1. I guess I've already talked about the higher value of T and S, so I'll skip forward. The important thing is we need enough token counts that this algorithm has time to adjust the numbers to the correct values and to settle them in place. And so it's important that we don't calculate the whole contest and at the end say, yellow won, and that's the end. Yellow beat red or red beat yellow, and give 1 point to red for winning the whole game. Instead, we want the measurements to be every few minutes so that the results by the end of a weekend are a fairly accurate measurement of the teams. Discrimination means how well we can tell the skills of two players based on the events that we have in the scoring system. If we use higher values of S, then the speed of the score changes will be fast, but anyone doing surprisingly well, for instance, an accidental security discovery or out of the ordinary performance on a person by one of the players will impact very badly the scores. And so we want to be protected, and we want to use something like the token database to test the values before we go public with a system like this. But even if we don't get S&T quite right, it only means that we need to wait more contests before we announce the results. In chess, no matter how good or bad you play, you are not allowed to announce your rating until you've played 20 games. I believe that we could announce the results even with bad values of S&T after 3 or 4 games with this system. And if we choose the values of S effectively, then in one contest we can measure relative skill fairly accurately with reliable results. One thing to note is that if we have a contest in Las Vegas during the summer and 8 teams play, and we have another contest in Tokyo in autumn and 8 different teams play, then because we don't know if all 8 teams in Tokyo were here and all 8 teams in Las Vegas were here, they're going to appear to be equal in the rating system until we get the players to compete against each other in cross-nation or cross-ocean contests, which will then tell us that a team that did poorly here just really does well against the teams, for instance, in the United States, and then we will know how to adjust the ratings in the U.S. to balance. So we do need to have enough contests with enough cross-play that the ratings measure everyone effectively, and that they work that way. So this would take many contests, but each contest will be very accurately measured right off from the first try. Convergence time is the second property, and this talks about how long does it take after we find out what the scores are, what the ratings of players are, how long does that take to settle? And so if red team attacks yellow team and wins, then red team's score goes very high and yellow team's score goes very low. But then yellow does one attack correctly, and if our scores are wrong, then the scores will change very quickly back toward each other. And so the convergence time is the measure of how long it takes to adjust the scores until they work out to be consistent, so that in a year we can use the numbers again to measure the same players. Reaching the balanced state, where the ratings actually match the player's skill, is the amount of time we call the convergence time. And the ideal setup selection of S and T will give us a convergence time which is less than 1 day. And that lets us have one contest, one event, or one forum to measure all the skills of all the players who are there. There are other density functions that describe how a player might perform. Density is a technical description of the Fermi function. But the Fermi function is completely sufficient, so we don't need any more math than the one that we just showed, or I just showed. So without needing a whole complex set of math, we can measure very effectively the ratings. We can converge them in a day, and we can put them up on the screen. Unfortunately, people will naturally believe that a negative number, if my rating is -2, then people will think that I'm very, very bad, even if that means that I'm only a little worse than average. For instance, if the scores go from -1 million to +1 million, and my score is -2, I'm not very good, but I'm definitely not terrible. And so we can't effectively present the zero-centered rating system to the public. And so conveniently, we can use the Fermi function a second time to bring all the numbers into a positive range. It's just important to understand that a value of 0.1 might be the best score rank in the entire game, depending on our values of S and T. And so that's not friendly to executives and to people who want to understand and interact with the numbers. And with continuous scores, they may be very unwieldy, so the score may be 0.1215, like that, forever. And be very difficult to communicate. So in the bottom here, again, if you compare, you'll see this matches the Fermi function from before. It's the same exact mathematics. And we can choose a number S. For instance, in this, 1,000, it means that all scores would come out in the rating from 0 to 1,000. And we use T in order to adjust these numbers very effectively. We automatically determine T by testing the highest and lowest values of observed players. So we take the best person's score, the worst person's score, we find the difference, we half it, and that happens to be a good guess for a value of T. If we have, I talked about this earlier with ELO requiring 20 games. If we have no data because a player just joined or is not playing the game, then our best guess is that the person is of average strength. If they have only been in the contest for 1 minute, their rating is, it's a number, and maybe it's positive because they've done well in 1 minute, but we don't know how long that's going to hold up, and so it's important that we don't overestimate how quickly the numbers gain value. And so we need to make sure that we require the players to participate for a fixed number, some minimum number of hours or of days, before we give out the results, before we publish. And like I said, if we choose S and T well, then the numbers, we can require them to play for 8 or 12 hours and get a fairly accurate estimate of their skill. The more ways you try to solve this problem of giving out ratings immediately, the worse the scoring system gets, and many online games today use a system like this, but they immediately turn around and give out ratings for players on day one, and the ratings are abusive, they're pathetic, they're terrible estimations, and players think that they're meaningful, and this causes lots of problems because a new player, if we award good players for defeating average players, then new good players will pick on and literally irritate the newest players in the game and keep them from being valuable parts of the society. And so we'll see the same thing in our contests. So we don't want to give out to anyone the estimates of the skills of players until they've played enough time for the ratings to converge. To compare this to another rating system, the ELO system to which I've referred, this is a system used by FIDE, the World Chess Federation, and their scoring, you begin with a rating of approximately 1,300. There's no belief in why that number is valid. The numbers change from year to year because as players stop playing, their existence and the points that they've taken from other players by winning, those points disappear in a sense. They're no longer in the economy of points. And so the numbers change from year to year with the FIDE system, the ELO. So the system I'm proposing is easier to explain because the scores go from 0 to 1,000 every time, always. Very easy for people to believe that that's a percentage skill measurement or other easy to understand intuitive scores. This one is somewhat more resistant to change over time because the scores are zero-centered instead of positive number-centered. The scores will tend to, as players are not participating after they leave the contest community, their scores will degenerate towards zero by the other players playing. And this is also more fine-grained. For instance, in a game, you know, Garry Kasparov versus Deep Blue, it took weeks to have the contest. They played 6 or 7 matches, and after which a small handful of points were exchanged, as opposed to in the 300 points, again, that I mentioned, that yellow team took in 34 hours from the red team. even though chess is somewhat similar in complexity level to security hacking games. So we get out of our system a much better analysis of skill much more quickly than the chess community gets from theirs. And the chess community has been relying on those scores for many years. So this system, I think, can be very effectively compared to professional scoring systems of that variety. My opinion is that we should encourage security games, and the reason we should do that is to improve the skills and capabilities of our administrators. I believe that the games rely on the scoring system to provide meaningful results, and that because those results are meaningful, we can then go forward to present a consistent scoring and rating scheme for the industry. We can measure the abilities of various consultants in this form, and from that we can derive relative competency measures, which you cannot do today. Today, as I said before, if you hire a consultant, the best answer you can get back from them is, we did not find any vulnerabilities. Unfortunately, that's exactly the answer that you'll get out of a gumball machine, or, as we say in Seattle, what you get from a fortune cookie. You'll have nice weather today. That's not a good answer, and you've got no reason to believe that the good answer that you hope to get from a consultant is worthwhile. The other option is to hire two teams of consultants and hope that they don't know each other and check their answers against each other at the end of the day. Because of speaking lecture circuits and other community access, most of us who have done consulting know each other, and we may or may not, I don't consult any longer, but people may or may not collaborate behind the scenes to tamper with the results of their competitive security analysis in order to make sure that both companies come out with excellent ratings. So most of the ways that people defend against liars in the consulting community are not effective. The real way to do it is to force them to compete. We can measure that competition. We can go forward from there to derive very good value from what we know about the security consultants. That's all I have to say. I really hope from the audience there are questions. I guess we're done a little bit early. So I would invite first anybody to come and ask any questions you have. If not, then I'll pick on Tom like we did during the panel, because I know he's a smart cat. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that. Right. Some of that's a secret, and I can't answer. But the first thing we plan on changing is taking away the limitation of 8 teams. We think that the game can be more self-organizing. To that effect, we're organizing a game called Mega Root Foo in, we believe, February of this coming year. We're hoping for as many as 3,000 hackers competing against each other to take a prize by attacking each other and by us scoring and validating that the teams are doing well. If that goes off well, we would like to present a rating system of what we think are the best hackers with public talent and who are able to share their skills, in order to give them fame and some praise for showing the world what the state of the art is. because we think that's so important, the decentralized game is critically important for us to design and create well for next year. Additionally, we want to move the scoring system off so that there isn't a ninth virtual team in the router. We'd like for the teams to actually implement the entire scoring system themselves as well. And this will remove any possibility of cheating on the part of by analyzing the contest network itself. If we can do that, then we believe that we have the capability to present a possibly a universal hacker scoring game that does not necessarily need to end. So, and thank you for playing the game, by the way. Also, I do have simultaneous translation, so if anybody wants to ask a question in Japanese, I am very fine to listen to it from our wonderful translators in the booth. Excellent question. The team, Ghetto Hackers bring a computer, a disk image that is a VMware bootable software computer. He's got his earpiece on. We present a bootable CD image that the teams use. Then they bring their own laptop, they put the disk in and boot it, and then that brings up their whole operating system and all the services so that each team has exactly the same configuration. The only difference that we give them is a floppy disk usually with a public key on it. And this last year we actually burned the public keys into each of the team's CD images manually. That's a hard problem to solve if we're talking about 3,000 players, so I don't know how most effectively to differentiate the different images, but yes, we do. We just provide the software half of it. This year, because it was Microsoft, we paid for 16 Windows licenses and SQL Server licenses. Since we live nearby, it was actually a little bit less expensive for us to do that. We used the employee store to purchase inexpensive licenses, and then we just used them for that weekend. Does that answer your question? Anybody else? Yeah, that's why I said that it was going to be really important for us to design that well, is because the identity question is, in the end, really the hard part. We have several ideas. The simplest one is that we don't care. If you can spoof the network or take over the identity of someone else, then as long as the game is designed similarly to the internet, then that's a valid attack. That's a very reasonable way to participate in the game. If you can intercept someone else's offensive capability and do that, then that's, again, another very valid way to interact in the real world from the perspective of a hacker. And the defenders who are trying to win the game really need to be able to stop those kinds of things. So I would say, first and foremost, we don't care if people can cheat. It's a cheating game. And secondly, we're going to try to stop them anyway. So one way to do that is to make a mesh network, and this sort of is where this ties over into what I do for a day job, is to make a secure, not anonymous, in other words, a named mesh network. But that only goes so far because it's going to be carried on the public internet. So I don't know the answer yet. My first response would be to ask someone to enumerate the actual differences between the two. I did a year of vulnerability analysis and penetration testing. I guess that's the vulnerability analysis and penetration consultants are who I'm talking about. And I don't think their skills differ in any way than the skills of a hacker. And if they do, that's a failure on their part. If you don't know what the state of the art of hacking is, if you cannot execute those operations, then you have no business, in my opinion, telling people what hackers will do to them. I think you really must know those skills. Sure, absolutely. I would think that it would be the responsibility of PQR then to bring consultants in who would try to provide that service for them and to present them with the software and put this game on for themselves. Quite precisely, yes, you must, the criteria for a successful scoring system relies on the believability of the numbers. And so this year, for instance, defending Windows, MySQL, and MS SQL against attackers is not a very valid measure of how well someone defends OpenBSD or how well someone attacks it. So it's categorical in nature, the skills being measured. So we might have to have a different category of defending and attacking for each platform or for mixed environments. In this way, I can see there being different events, sort of like the triathlon or the decathlon. It's true, but I think that the industry is biased in which software it deploys anyway. We deploy more Windows than we deploy, say, Apple's, and so testing people's ability to use and defend Microsoft operating systems, I think, is far more valuable than testing their ability to attack or defend Macs. It doesn't mean that that's the only thing in the world, and we should have the contests reflect what the mix of the deployed technology are. But because the world is so biased toward two or three technologies in a given category, I think that with two or three contests, we can cover the vast majority of capabilities. And I think that if a company has Apple in one room and Windows in another room, then they should have two contests and make some scoring system to scale how important they consider the Windows capability versus how important they consider the Macintosh capability. And if they're not mixable, then hire two different groups of consultants. I think that there's more information learned from the bias than information lost.
So the final question then is, you mentioned something you're packaging the software and delivering, like maybe the Microsoft solution?
I'm actually not. I've been so busy with genetic programming and automated vulnerability and software creation. And with mesh networking that I've all but ceased my private work on scoring systems. So I'm hoping that by presenting the information in a couple of public forums, I can find someone who has the corporate muscle and the technical capability as well as the integrity and reputation to take this forward. I don't really care if people have scoring systems. What I really care about is that we have a scoring consortium or an agreement in public on how to score people, because I think it's very sad that people charge the same price for me to do consulting as they do for you, because you're a lot better at it than I am, and I still got a lot of money billing, way too much money billing when I did the work.
Oh,
You know, it was surprising. We got, in one contest, within the first hour, a team made a tunnel to the public internet and brought in some hired guns and created Oday for a service that we wrote. It was like 37 minutes, I think, between the time that the contest began and the first time that the signature of the attack was put on the network. We have the whole packet dump. We saw how it was built. It was very clearly built by one particular company, one particular group's piece of exploit development software. We know how and why, and we've got a pretty good idea who did the build. 0 days, because we generally deploy realistic services, the people generally use more like your techniques of sort of interactive SQL injection or other similar interactive skills more than exploits. Rooting the system isn't that interesting in the real world. It's way more interesting to collect data. I'd rather have a credit card number than root on the machine that the credit card numbers were once entered into. Because with root I can be detected, and with a credit card number I can be rich. So I'd rather have the information in most cases. So exploits aren't used a whole lot in the contest, but we have had, I believe, in 3 years, 4 zero-day exploits that we caught in later analysis of the situation. The question on the floor was, were the exploits that were created generated for our services or for the already deployed or already existing commercial off-the-shelf ones? And three of them were against services that we created, and one of them was a zero-day that was later announced that a company already knew existed, that had not been publicly disclosed yet, and that they had not yet patched. And so what we saw was exactly what we're not supposed to ever see, which was during a moratorium on a release, someone had the actual exploit and was using it. So this indicates exactly to me what people say over and over and over, which is that everybody has 0 days. They are out there. They're being used. You cannot hope that patching is good enough. You just can't do it. You have to take active defense. You have to monitor your services. You have to have someone inspect the traffic. You have to do everything you can. You have to use signature-based detection schemes because they catch idiots. It's not going to stop the good people, but maybe the good people aren't looking at you this day and you get lucky. If you don't stop the idiots, if you don't stop the mid-grade people, if you don't stop the really good people, if you don't stop each level that you refuse to take action against, means that that's all the more often that your reputation goes in the hole. That's not acceptable.
I heard you say that you went to the store and what are the ways that you can get those people
out? Yeah. We don't have very good measures of all forms of self, but we do. Our assumption really is just that we want to encourage self, but in the real world, most companies do a very terrible job of monitoring, and so self isn't that important. So that our decision was to put a small, simple self meter in the game and not to go more complicated. So we don't have further technology for measuring self. Thanks for the question. Does anyone else have any questions? We're actually pretty close to the end. If nobody has further questions. Thank you very much.